We have to use this, don't we? Oh, look, you can make little hand puppet signs on it.
Yeah, we're recording.
Well, good morning and welcome to Ecumenism 101. We're delighted to have you with us today. There is a lot to learn about ecumenism, including a recognition that on the National Workshop brochure, Desert Pilgrimage, the title of the morning seminar number one says ecumenism with two eyes.
The extra eyes for interfaith.
Well planned. So here is ecumenism, and that gives us a sense already of what we need to learn together. In this time this morning, first let me introduce to you Dr. Thomas Ferguson, who is the Associate Deputy to the Presiding Bishop for Ecumenical and Interreligious Relations for the Episcopal Church. Tom and I have been colleagues for 5 years, and this is the second time we've had this course, so we think we're going to take it on the road next year. We're delighted that you have joined us. We will spend the first half hour or so discussing with you what we see to be the historic development of ecumenism, and then also the challenges as we understand them today. After that time, we'd like to open it up to discourse, so we have some conversation together. So I hope you're thinking,
preparing your.
I know, I'm all about discourse. It's very Lutheran of me. You know, we want to talk, and so we hope very much that you will think of your inquiries and questions as you go along. It's a pleasure to see you, and I'm just going to hand this immediately over to Dr. Ferguson. Thank you.
Thank you, my brother. Welcome to you all. I'm glad to see you all here today. We're going to, as my colleague mentioned, we're going to break this roughly into two parts. The first half will be kind of a quick major issues kind of overview of the course and development of ecumenism, and then my colleague will bring us to the modern period and talk about some of the ways the ecumenical movement is changing and some of the particular challenges we're facing in the future. So without further ado, let's get it going here. I'm going to talk a little bit about the prehistory of ecumenical involvement. In many ways, the history of the ecumenical movement in the American context hasn't really been written, because to do so, in essence, is to write a history of American Christianity from an ecumenical context. Because for the first century before there was a quote-unquote formal ecumenical movement, the story of ecumenism is told in the ways how denominations developed and engaged in mutual mission and ministry together. And we can see some of this in the last half of the 1700s and the beginnings of the 1800s, which the way churches worked together before we had national staffs and big shining buildings in big cities near airports. In the days before we had an understanding of national staffs and program units, the way the churches worked together were through these voluntary societies, were through these societies that were formed and whose main purpose was to do the mission and ministry of the church. Things like the American Bible Society, the Board of Commissioners for Domestic Missions, the Tract Society, the Evangelical Society, which was an ecumenical organization that brought together evangelicals from a variety of American denominations. It was through these voluntary societies that the churches did a lot of their mission and ministry together. And they were all very ecumenical, and a lot of them were some of the largest organizations of the time. They were kind of the General Motors of their day. When you look at the staff, well, it's not a good analogy anymore, is it? No, it's not 1955 anymore. They were the Microsoft of their day. They had enormous staff, substantial sums of money in terms of the individual members. They were called voluntary societies because they often raised their funds through membership donations. You would be a member of the Evangelical Society and through your dues and participation. So these are organizations that had enormous resources, large numbers of staff and program work, and it's how churches did stuff. And so this is part of the prehistory of how ecumenism got started in its American context. Come on in, brother, right down in the front. We're not going to do it all at the call, don't worry. We got one here, we got one there, we got one in the back.
I'm Catholic, I'm supposed to sit in the back.
That's another ecumenical thing we have in common. Nobody likes to sit down front. Why do you think they had to start the altar calls, right? Nobody said. That's why they had to get the worrying bench down front, to get people who would come down front. So there was, through the formation of these voluntary societies, and also some of the first quote-unquote ecumenical agreements were in the contexts of mission and ministry. You can see this in the Plan of Union between the Congregational Church and the Presbyterian Church of the time, which was a proposal for interchangeability of ministries sort of what we would kind of call full communion now. But in that context, it was specifically for mission across the Alleghenies and in the New Frontier. And the Plan of Union came about in the early 1800s, one of the first formal ecumenical agreements. And the key is, it's in this context of mission and ministry together. As I say here, full disclosure and disclaimer, my own tradition, the Episcopal Church, consciously kind of stood apart from a lot of these ecumenical organizations. And other denominations did this too. Some of the newly formed American religious traditions, some of them, like the Disciples of Christ, were so radically ecumenical they didn't see the need for this kind of stuff. So for various reasons, differing denominations would sometimes stand apart. But the vast bulk of the ecumenical work was in this context of mission and ministry and through these voluntary societies. Early modern period. Of course, this is church history, so early modern starts after the Civil War. Right? That's our definition of modern. We have different understandings of this. In the post-Civil War period, the problems in American society have gotten enormously complex and complicated. We have industrialization and urbanization. You know, Chicago was a little village. In 1833, Chicago was a little village with 20 houses on the shore of Lake Michigan. In 1833, 67 years later, it has 2 million people. I mean, the context and scale of industrialization and urbanization in the 1800s, there's the question of, in a post-Civil War context, how to deal with African Americans who have been granted freedom and how to incorporate them or not into the ministries of the church, the ways in which denominations are trying to figure out how to deal with the enormous issues facing American society in the post-Civil War period. This is when the global mission movement really takes off. Now, we're going to missionize the world in this generation was the mantra of the global missionary movement. So a whole new set of organizations start to be created in this post-Civil War period. Various denominations found what they call freedmen's commissions. There's the Board of Auxiliary for Foreign Missions in the Episcopal Church. In a sense, they can no longer rely on these purely voluntary societies. So in the post-Civil War period, we're beginning to see denominations start to form units to handle these issues in the church. And so instead of individual members from a variety of denominations doing the work together, we have denominations establishing things to do their mission work and then having those institutions begin to work collaboratively or not with one another. So there's a shift. The goal and the emphasis is the same, but given the way denominations were changing and given the way the issues facing the country and the churches were changing, now there's, instead of individuals in organizations, we have institutions creating program units which then are in conversation with one another. And one of the ways which we can see this is the formation of the Federal Council of Churches in 1908, the first attempt at having a national ecumenical body of some kind. The Federal Council of Churches, the name was chosen because it saw itself as a federated kind of clearinghouse for the way the churches do their work. They said, hey, we're creating all these new institutions and organizations and program units of our churches. How can we get them to be better involved with one another? So it specifically chose this name, Federal Council, because it was considered itself kind of a federated model. It wasn't, and this is one of the main reasons the Episcopal Church didn't join it, is because it was not specifically devoted towards Christian unity. It was kind of a clearinghouse for how churches do their work and how to be better in communication with one another. The Episcopal Church would consistently say, we have no problem with what you're doing, but we're committed to the more visible unity of the church, and we don't see you doing that. And, of course, denominations are working on their internal unity at this point as well, where we have the whole sea of Lutheran synods and organizations beginning that march towards merger from, you know, the 12,000 or so, it seems. That, how many, Michael? That's about 12,000 in the 1800s. That sounds right, yeah. We see the eventual march towards unity among some traditions that are very dispersed, some of the Methodist, Lutheran, and Presbyterian churches. And also in this early modern period, we're beginning to see something that will, hopefully my colleague will talk about in a little bit, things that will profoundly change aspects of how American Christianity and ecumenical work goes on, specifically with the birth of the Pentecostal movement, changing patterns of immigration. You know, American Christianity will cease to be largely a European-American Protestant-dominated movement, and new church developments and different patterns of immigration internally, folks shifting from the south to the north, and also eventually how immigration patterns nationally will start to change. That's part of the early modern period, the early 20th century. 1910 is usually considered to be the kickoff of the modern ecumenical movement. And again, context is important. It was within the context of the global mission movement. A bunch of folks got together and said, we're trying to missionize this world, and we have to stop competing with one another. The Global Missionary Conference was called in 1910 to try and begin to get all the churches which have this dispersed ecumenical work all over the world in global mission to try and be more in conversation with one another. It was by far the broadest ecumenical meeting of the time. One scholar has referred to it as the most ecumenical Christian gathering since the Council of Nicaea. In terms of the breadth of Christian, it was still, we shouldn't fool ourselves, it was still largely a European-dominated pan-Protestant group with a little bit of on the side as well. But we shouldn't. But nonetheless, for its time, it still was a very, very broad ecumenical gathering. And here's another important sort of shift in how the ecumenical movement is moving from this pre-modern to this modern period. It's still grounded. Remember what we've talked about. Ecumenical cooperation throughout the 1800s is really grounded in mission and ministry. People worked ecumenically, but always with that end goal in their sights. And they worked ecumenically to get the various institutions by which they did their work to play nicer together. And so in some sense, the Edinburgh Missionary Conference is an extension of how we did our ecumenical work in the 1800s, focused on mission and ministry. How can we work together better ecumenically? But the key is, several members stood up as well, among them the future Archbishop of York, William Temple, and a missionary bishop of the Episcopal Church, Charles Henry Brent, who said, that's not enough. We have to learn to understand each other better. If we're never going to begin to come to a better understanding of our theological differences, we're not going to be successful in our endeavor to work together in mission. So there's an important shift in the ecumenical movement as it emerges from Edinburgh, where they're saying it's not okay, it's not enough anymore to simply say we need to work together. We've got to start addressing those things that divide us. And this emerges as consensus that comes out of the Edinburgh Missionary Conference and eventually results and two important meetings in the 20s. There are a couple wars scattered in here, which sets back some of the work that's going on. So the 1925 Conference on Life and Work, which becomes ecumenical jargon for that mission and ministry stuff. How are we going to do our work together as Christians? It's held in Stockholm, Sweden, with the great Archbishop Nathan Soderblom, Lutheran Archbishop of the Church of Sweden as its main organizer, who also won the Nobel Peace Prize for his many, many efforts towards peace and Christian unity. It's held in 1925 in Stockholm, and its cousin, and the 1927 Conference on Faith and Order, which becomes the organization created to deal with those specifically theological issues, spearheaded by Bishop Charles Henry Brent. Now, coming out of these two movements in the 20s begins to be the notion that we need a global body to deal with this stuff. So the ideas for the formation of a World Council of Churches come out of this, and it's interrupted by the Second World War. Briefly on the formation of ecumenical organizations. We talked about the Federal Council of Churches, which really was kind of a forum and a clearinghouse. The bodies that succeeded in the post-war period are different in an important sense. World Council of Churches formed in 1948 and the National Council of Churches of Christ in 1950. On the one hand, they are this amalgam of mission and ministry stuff. You know, the National Council of Churches brought together some organizations which were founded in the 1850s and the 1860s, and they came under the umbrella of the National Council. But on the other hand, the World Council of Churches and the National Council are significant in that they pledge themselves specifically to the work of Christian unity. They make that their primary goal, to walk that path together. The National Council of Churches calling itself a community of communions in some of its organizational documents. Now, there's a subtle shift and how the WCC and the NCC are understanding themselves is not only this kind of clearinghouse for how churches are doing their work ecumenically, but we will work together and pledge ourselves to the better understanding and to the more visible unity of the church. Oh gosh, see, this is where I have to talk even faster than I normally do during this part of it. Beginnings of dialogues. In the post-World War II period, we also begin to see the birth of what will initially be global, international dialogues and a lot of national-based dialogues. Second Vatican Council is another incredibly important shift in the ecumenical movement where, you know, the largest church in Christendom fully engages in ecumenism. And coming out of the Roman Catholic Church, while not joining the World Council of Churches, the Roman Catholic Church nonetheless is involved in a lot of the program work of the WCC. They're involved in Faith and Order. They sit on a number of the committees that do the program work. They're not formally joining the council as a whole. Roman Catholic Church engages the ecumenical movement, overshadowed a bit by the Second Vatican Council, the 1964 Pan-Orthodox Conference. As much as you can get the Orthodox churches to agree on anything, you kind of do it. You know, they have a different polity and structure. The Orthodox begin to engage the global ecumenical movement coming out of that conference in 64. And we see the beginning of these dialogues. One of the more, I talked about some of those national dialogues. One of the ones that is known here in the American context is the Consultation on Church Union. Who remembers the old COCU? Raise your hand if the words COCU bring a warm glow to your heart. Raise your hand if the words COCU leave you kind of confused and terrified. Consultation on Church Union. Back in the old days when religious leaders used to get in the cover of Time magazine for doing stuff that wasn't illegal, Eugene Carson Blake preached a sermon at Grace Cathedral where he called for a church truly, he was the stated clerk of what was then the United Presbyterian Church, calling for a church that was truly Catholic and truly Reformed. And he was joined with Bishop James Pike of California. And eventually they would be joined by what would become the United Methodist Church, who added the kind of the third leg of the Consultation on Church Union, seeking a church truly evangelical, truly Catholic, and truly Reformed. This body will exist in a number of incarnations and permutations. It eventually will have 10 member communions who will join it in various phases of its life. The Episcopal Church, the United Methodist Church, the Presbyterian Church USA, the American African Methodist Episcopal Church, African Methodist Episcopal Zion, Christian Methodist Episcopal, Christian Church Disciples of Christ, United Church of Christ, International Council of Community Churches. Eventually the Moravian Church Northern Province will join. And there's always one that I forget. Maybe I didn't do it this time. Did I forget any this time around? Did I forget? If I did, it's because it's hard to remember all 10 of them. So this will be formed. And it, part of the key is, in some places, unity is achieved. We have another round of institutional denominational mergers. The UCC will be formed of the Christian Connection, the Congregational Church is located in the Northeast, and the Evangelical Church in the Midwest. The ELCA, this process of merger from Lutheran bodies, will continue. There'll be the healings of the Civil War divides over slavery with the PCUSA, the Methodist Church, which then becomes the United Methodist Church, the Uniting Church in Canada, which will bring together a broad range of Protestant groups. The international dialogues go like gangbusters. This is not an exclusive list of them. These are some of the longest running and more important ones. And continuing dialogues in the United States, Anglican, Roman Catholic, and Lutheran, Roman Catholic. 30 years of Anglican Lutheran dialogues resulted in full communion between the two. Christian Church Disciples of Christ, which is we reached a sort of covenantal relationship of interchangeability of ministries. And the last bit I'll talk about before turning it over is talk a little bit about the unity we seek. Organic unity, up until the 1960s, was what everyone was searching for. We'll have visible, organic, structural, institutional unity. Problem is people didn't want it. Remember that Consultation on Church Union? They came out with their plan of union in 1970, which proposed organic unity, a single pan-Protestant church, and every member denomination voted it down. Check with the constituency, right? Ecumenical lesson learned. Check with your constituency first. In the American context, the nature of the unity we seek is variously defined in certain ways as full communion. The problem is it's defined in different ways. It's like in The Princess Bride, where you keep saying, the word you are using, it does not mean what I think you think it means. There are different ways people have interpreted this. In the Roman Catholic Church, to be in full ecclesial communion with the bishop who is in turn in communion with Rome. Full communion. The definition is laid out in the Episcopal Church ELCA dialogues. It's a more fluid concept. There's interchangeability of ministries for the sake of mission and ministry. The churches remain autonomous but interdependent, and you let mission and ministry drive the structure that you needed. So see, the pendulum doesn't swing full turn. The wheel has spun full circle, And in this definition of full communion in the Episcopal Church and ELCA, we can see how some of the things we talked about at the very beginning, about ecumenism in its earliest incarnation in this American context, was always focused towards mission and ministry. And the way we did it dictated the kind of structure and cooperation we needed. So I think with this definition of full communion in the Episcopal Church ELCA conversation, we can see it coming full circle. And I think in some ways this is kind of the hope in the future of how we'll work ecumenically, is how can we bring it back to that focus on mission and ministry together, and let the way we do ecumenism be in the service of that. And with that, I will pause.
How long we had it on pause?
Oh. we're going to find out. There are distinctions between these two. And I do think that nationally and internationally you're finding efforts to address the methodologies for why we engage in interreligious relations in an urgent way now that we haven't seen before. And there are reasons for that. For example, you may have seen that the document that came out in October of 2007 from Muslim leaders all around the world, addressed to Christian leaders all around the world, called A Common Word Between Us and You. In it, it calls for effectively two things: a recognition of our common God and our common love for the neighbor. And it calls Muslims and Christians to move from word to deed and action in how we address one another around the world, but also how we seek peace. And it states and affirms that there will not be peace. There will be no peace in the world unless Muslims and Christians can get along. When you're faced with that kind of letter, unprecedented in history, it's not just a matter of developing the kinds of methodologies which have been, for the Roman Catholic Church, it's been a while, these methodologies have been developed. For others, we're catching up. It's not just a matter of meeting methodologies. It's learning how to speak with one voice in response. Or perhaps not with one voice that's universal, but with uniform voices. And those things are very relevant, I think, to be able to do that effectively and rather quickly in a world where communication and you know, the medium defines much of the message, where communication is happening a lot quicker now than before. So our time to think and our response time is much faster in an interreligious context as well as ecumenical, but the urgency of interreligious is certainly true. Where do we have? Where?
Did you have your hand up?
Sorry, can we go here? I'll come back to you.
Just keep it in.
In Kearney, Arizona, tiny town east of here, I'm an Episcopal priest pastoring the Methodist congregation, which is also seeking to include the LPA. And I'd like to share a bit of a dilemma still occurring, and that is the creative tension between those who feel all of these issues that we need to settle are so unimportant, let's just not worry about them, and on the other hand, really doing this with integrity. The one person said, why is wine so important to you? And then, why is Welch so important to you? Why is the common chalice such a big deal? You know, why are the little plastic cups that are not green anyway such a big deal for you? and so those kinds of questions really embody really important stuff, even while other people feel like you're diddling around with details that don't matter. So it's just sharing a dilemma on the ground of the whole dialogue. Mm-hmm.
Did you have a response to this, or did you? There was a comment made yesterday by a Lutheran member. The ELCA and the United Methodist Church are now looking at full communion with one another. The UMC already voted in it last August. And our time is coming up this August. We're also voting on sexuality and ordination, so it's going to be a very active August for us. And part of the question is, when someone ever says to me, Lutherans believe this, or Methodists practice this, I'm always clear to say, well, yeah, but I mean, I can think of a lot of Lutherans who disagree on how we understand the sacrament of the Eucharist, how we understand baptism. I mean, there's a lot of interior discussion going on inside every one of these. And I'm always quick to help remind in that. I'm not suggesting that always ends my sense of conflicts like this is that usually they have very little to do with the sacrament and more to do with underlying political issues. But I hope that's helpful in some way.
I mean, my take on some of the stuff that we've talked about in some of the United Methodist Episcopal dialogue is, if you can't explain why something's important, then it's not important and you need to leave it by the wayside. However, if it is important, it's an opportunity for you to better understand who you are and why these things are important.
Yes, and what we have to offer each other.
Right, right. Absolutely.
Our motto is we are standing in awe of God and of each other.
Right.
And we're just looking for what it is that we need to learn about one another in order to say, I stand in awe of that.
Yeah.
Now, I believe in my list of people, I had you, and then you, and then you. You still want to get in on this one?
Another 101 ecumenism comment that I think is important is I belong to a religious community that began the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity,
mm-hmm.
and we celebrated the centennial of prayer for unity, and so that's often a common experience.
Right, the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity. It's one of the times you can sort of get on the... the list of things to do in sort of a broader denomination is to,
much more than just, you know, one week a year.
Right.
But spiritual ecumenism is very important. And in the context of resources, there's a book that was just published, I think, about a month ago, called Praying for Unity, that is an anthology of ecumenical participation in that context. I think it's going to be available to be viewed at the breakfast that we're sponsoring.
Right. Right. I mean, spiritual ecumenism piece, how can we grow together in worship and spirituality, is an important sort of rediscovery. The key, of course, is it can't be a shorthand for not doing the other stuff. I mean, that's where the real challenge is going to be in spiritual ecumenism. Well, that's just, not that people are saying this, but the danger being, well, let's just pray together and not continue to work on that stuff. That's going to be the real challenge as this emerges as a way in which we do some of this stuff.
Do you think Cardinal Casper has some nice points on spiritual ecumenism?
He wrote a book that also...
Yeah, would you recommend that book to others?
Yes. Okay.
There seems to be a tension in my thinking between the desire to respect the other, the love your neighbor of a religious tradition that's different, and to become more the same. You know, to work together as one body of Christ within the ecumenical movement, and to eliminate our differences. And for example, in the last presentation, to pick a different Easter day, to be all one. You know, I mean, that would be the desire to blend traditions more as opposed to keep them separate and protect them. I sort of feel like if I was preaching on this, what would I say is the purpose of ecumenism? Is it to become one in Christ? Or is it respect who we are as different but be able to talk together, especially in post-denomination?
Oh, Jayla, thanks so much for that question. No, this is a great question. There are a couple of other comments with regard to your question.
Especially in post-denominational.
Right, right.
I find that having the opportunity to worship in a manner different than what I have always worshipped is an enriching experience. That doesn't mean that I change the way that I normally worship, because I still have my own relationship with God as I have, but it has become richer because I see how someone else worships God.
Well,
none
this is very, this
I
is very,
are that important.
Yeah, this is very, I mean, it's very interesting the way the three of you have talked about it, because I sense an urgency in your question about what gets forfeited when we become too kind of monolithic, if that's the whole goal of the quest for Christian unity, and the way the two of you just spoke about it.
I don't give that up.
Right.
I don't give up my authenticity.
Authenticity or relationality, which may be, the fear may be that gets lost in a kind of monolithic quest for Christian unity. I want to say first, and I don't, I'll come right to you, sir. I don't think that the quest for Christian unity requires a kind of sameness where we're all marching lockstep in the same direction. And the body of Christ and the many members of that body is not a rhetorical point. And so it needs to be expressed fully. And that means that we will have significant differences with one another. But that also means that we have the capacity to be more than cooperative with each other as well. There's this kind of line, you know, of ecumenical cooperation all the way to unity and structural merging. And all of those require different things from us in the sense of relationship. A lot of the work that we do, it depends on who you ask this question. So I can tell you the work that we do in terms of the quest for Christian unity is to recognize that we're not looking for sameness but similarity. We're not trying to overcome difference, but to hold up those differences that make us identifiable for who we are, and that each one of those offer specific strengths to us. In the EOCA Episcopal Church relationship, we've learned a tremendous amount from our Episcopal brothers and sisters. There are 40 to 50,000 Moravians in the United States, and we're in full communion with the Moravian Church, northern and southern provinces, and the east-west Indies province. We've learned a tremendous amount, everything from hymnody to piety from them. To lose that in the monolithic would be foolish. And I think that the ecumenical movement recognizes those differences are important. What happens in the conversation is, when does something become church dividing? And that usually takes place inside a bilateral dialogue that has been going on for a number of years. Another example, just coming out of our own heritage, I mentioned that UMC, we're just coming to the end of a 30-year dialogue. With the Roman Catholic Church, it's been 40 years. These dialogues take time. That doesn't mean we shouldn't be working on the ground and doing grassroots and doing all this ecumenical, wonderful work. That's all a part of the unity that we seek. But those dialogues are also important, and they take time for thought and reflection and development. And that's one of the reasons why the Joint Declaration on the Doctrine of Justification that was mentioned earlier was a result of that level of dialogue. So I hope that's helpful at getting some of your...
And one of the mantras we kind of have in the Episcopal Church is we talk about the ecumenism of the possible. What's possible in any given context? And you kind of ask yourself that question. And you do whatever is possible. And the thing is, this allows for a kind of flexibility. I mean, for two congregations that have a good relationship and a common mission and ministry, they can plow ahead and do some things that might not have been possible in other places. On a national level, what does it mean to be in dialogue with Roman Catholics as opposed to United Methodists? Well, those two conversations have different sets of parameters to them. So we continually, when we're trying to ask ourselves that question, what is the nature and kind of unity that we seek, is to try and take into account the different contexts to that and say, well, what's possible? And what's our goal and what's possible in this particular relationship? And then work on that and be okay with that. Well, not be sort of comfortable and okay with it. But I mean, to say, yeah, it's going to take a couple hundred years.
Well, I think it is what we focus upon in terms of what our identity is. The real question, as I see it, is we ought to meet Christ where he is, broken.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the church in the ghetto, well, past telling his people how to become prosperous, you're not going to find Jesus there. If you go into suburbia, and where the pastor is telling his people to be nice to the underclass, you won't find Jesus there. Jesus is in the ghetto, poverty and suffering, humiliation. And if you won't find Jesus plotting with the people to overcome their oppression, and when you unite with Jesus and participate in that overthrow of oppression, etc., you come to know Jesus. You meet him as he is, the liberator and the salvation of mankind. And if that can't bring you together,
right. Well said. And there has been a way in which that has woven itself at various times in the ecumenical movement, and not. I mean, we need to acknowledge those places where it hasn't happened. Remember, the National Council of Churches was one of the sponsors of the March on Washington in 1963. And one of the representatives from the NCC spoke on that August day in 1960. There have been ways in which the broader ecumenical movement has tied in with some of these things, and sadly ways in which it has not. And part of that continuously recalling the churches to that.
And what your religious practice is in worship, in ceremony, etc., becomes inconsequential. That's right.
But only in so much that we can get that out of the way and focus ourselves.
Well, I mean, you get it out of the way by finding out where Jesus is at work.
And I'm saying it's not inconsequential if we can find a way to reconcile it, because then that will free us up from talking about that stuff and refocus ourselves. Sure.
She talks about the problem of reconciling ceremonial differences, and I'm saying if you focus on how we worship together is one thing. the other thing is to find out where Jesus is at work in the Word.
One of the things that, thank you, I mean, one of the things that we've talked about in, recently is in one of the ecumenical dialogues is on the theology of the cross, which is the idea that at the intersection of human suffering and oppression is what you just said, you find Christ. And our response to that in terms of who we are as Christians and in our ecumenical movement, how we do that together is supremely important. Thank you very much for your... we have time for one more? One more question?
I'll just go up the fact that I'm very into the ecumenical movement, so I'm in the, one of the level fours, Roger Bradley, fourth flavor. So this may be irrelevant, but it seems to me, I agree with you, Michael, I think the discourse of human sexuality may be a deal breaker, but I'm wondering if another deal breaker might be power.
Power?
We invest our hierarchy denomination with power, and to get together, we might have to share some of that.
Right. Not at all. Thanks for coming. sorry. I think it's one of the concerns has been early on in these ecumenical dialogues that as we were moving towards unity, people started to hear the word merger. And the word merger meant, I can tell you I don't mean to keep talking out of the Lutheran, but I'm more passionate about that perhaps because that's where I stand and that's my locus is. You know, there were a lot of Lutherans who believed that the Episcopalians would be coming over hill and dale to join us, you know, to kind of take over the Lutheran Church. We were very concerned. And we can kind of, you know, poke a little fun now, but it was a legitimate concern at that time. And this sense of merger and of sharing power structures, I think, is one we need to really address now in terms of how we understand polity, how we understand the ways in which we can do this work most effectively. There are segments of the population in various geographies of this country who would say they're rather relatively isolated, who would say we want to have no sharing structurally of that kind. And there are others who are sharing so much structurally already that it just makes perfect sense in the way that you had mentioned. It makes perfect sense to share even more. So there's no single line in all of this. I think what we will find, however, in the coming years, when you have diminishing resources, is a more concerted effort, and we're already seeing some of this, of these denominations working together at more structural levels in terms of power. And we are seeing it at the level of mission, training, young adult formation, how we do our interreligious dialogue, new mission starts. I mentioned the Moravians earlier. I do so because Dr. Otto Dreidoppel, who's a professor the Moravian Seminary in Pennsylvania, we've had some conversation because he serves on the coordinating committee for the Lutheran Moravian bilateral, and part of the conversation there has simply been the recognition that the new trainer for New Start congregations in the Moravian Church Northern Province is a Lutheran. That's the kind of... But I think your intuitions about power and structure are important and important to pay attention to.
Right, and the last bit I'll say about that is, yeah, this whole question of power is linked with identity as well. And, you know, the earliest definition of idolatry is to worship something else other than God. And I think that if there are ways in which how we understand ourselves to be Christian becomes something more than a way in which we can work better towards the bringing of the kingdom of God, then we're committing idolatry.
Thank you so much for your questions and conversation, correspondence. It was great, and have a wonderful rest of the National Workshop.